There's a new world coming, it's already here. There's a new world on its way. There's a new world coming, it's already here. Let's begin to live that way.
Welcome to the Children, Youth, and a New Kind of Christianity podcast series. The following presentation was recorded live at the 2012 CYNKC conference organized by Dave Sinis and others in Washington, D.C., and presented by Calvary Baptist Church, Woodlake Publishing, Virginia Theological Seminary, and Emergent Village. On May 7 through 10 of that year, conversation partners from seven countries and over 20 denominational traditions gathered to question, share, and be inspired by the alternative trajectory children and youth ministry is taking in certain contexts. Here now, John Westerhoff, who spoke at the conference entitling his reflections, Changing Times, Changing Responses.
Can you imagine?
It's good to be here. In fact, indeed, it is an honor to be here. You are an amazing group of people because you don't represent anything except people in a search. You come from all kinds of places and all kinds of traditions, yet you have a common question. And that's what brings us together and ought to always bring us together. I was overwhelmed by the invitation to be here. As I near 80, I don't do as much of this as I used to. I was on the road all the time for a while. But I've been striving for those 55 years to try to understand what this conference is about. But first, I just might make a few remarks about what I'm going to be engaged in this evening. I've always been troubled by the power that comes to those of us who have the audacity to get up and give lectures. Until I found some wisdom in the Sufi tradition. The Sufis are the mystics and teachers within Islam. They have a whole series of stories by a character named Nasruddin. And one day Nasruddin is sitting in his house minding his own business, and his neighbor comes over and knocks on the door and says, "Nasruddin, may I borrow your donkey?" Nasruddin does not want to loan out his donkey, so he says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I just loaned him out yesterday." At that point, the donkey brays in the barn. Neighbor, I've got him, what's that I hear in the barn? And Nasruddin says, "Are you going to believe me or a donkey?" Well, that's my warning to you. My definition of a professor is one who professes what they believe at the moment in order to stimulate people to think for themselves. And my aim tonight is to help you to ask some new questions and help you to argue with some new possible answers. The reason I chose not to use overhead projector or PowerPoints or something is that they always remind me of the idea that you think you're supposed to learn what's up there. I've never believed that. I've always told students, I don't want you to take notes of what I said, and certainly if you ever repeat them in an exam, you'll get an F, because I'll be bored, if nothing else. I want you to take your notes. Notes of what you heard, not what I said. You'll never know what I said. You'll only know what you chose to hear. Therefore, if you get upset at any of it, don't get upset with me. Get upset with you. You heard. And what I'm going to do is to try to create a Jackson Pollock painting. If you know Jackson Pollock, contemporary artist, canvas on the floor, splash paint on it, dribble paint all over it, and something was created. Well, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to splash paint, spread it around, and hopefully when you're finished, there'll be a picture there you want to look at for a while. So I wanted to start by reflecting on our times and move to some possible responses to it. In order to make sense of the present or to envision a possible future, we need to try to remember the past, at least the past as we experience it. As Faulkner wrote, the past is never dead. In fact, the past is not ever even past. We are our stories, And so we need to ask continually, not only what do we remember, but why do we remember it? There are some things we remember. There are some things we never remember or refuse to remember. There are some things that we remember that never happened. But what's important is what's stored in those memories, because we are our stories. And each of us has a story, and the story is always in relationship with God's story. And out of this conversation back and forth, it is our story together, our corporate story, that helps us to understand God's story. Each of us will have different memories, and each of us will remember different things for different reasons. But it's good for us to ask why. It's a matter of memory, it's a matter of writing history. History is very complex. History is a work in progress. It's something we are always revising. No single account of the past can ever describe it completely. And so we want to look at some about the past, but they'll be very broad, brief strokes. And they'll be primarily in the Western European East-West tradition, because that's what most of us share. But it's not the world's understanding. In fact, most of the conflicts that are occurring in the world today within religious communities is between those who have different memories and different visions of what the world is to be like, because they come from different cultures. So I want to look first. The church never exists in a vacuum. It always exists in some historical, some cultural, some social phenomena. And so we're living into that. But we will not do our best to describe the content as we open it. Once we know what that history is going on, or at least some different pictures of that history, then we need to always ask three questions. Is this something that I ought to follow? This is something that is beneficial to my faith and my life. The opposite understanding is no, what's going on in the world is not. We need to withdraw from that world to save our own souls and to establish our way of understanding things for others to observe. And there are those who believe that, well, some of it's useful, all of it needs to be questioned, but somehow we also have to live with it, to live in but not of that world. All three of those are possible possibilities for how we deal with that history as we understand it and as we understand our own present time and history. Remembering that truth is always or best understood as two counter opposites in a healthy tension. Being in the middle is no good. Being in the middle means nobody's happy because you've denied both sides or only taken part of it. It's maintaining the tension, the equilibrium between those two positions. And if A is true, then Z has to be true too. You can't have it any other way. In fact, what is a heresy? A heresy is a truth gone mad. Every heresy is true. That's why you're attracted to it. But what it is, it's a heresy because it's denied the counter opposite. If you want a simple example, Jesus is fully human and fully divine, an absolute impossibility. But if you go too far with the human Jesus, you're going to be in trouble. That's a heresy. Go too far with the divine Jesus, that's a heresy. Somehow you have to maintain these two counter opposites in a healthy tension. That's the nature of truth, and therefore everybody always has a piece of it. And what we want to do is be attracted to those who have the opposite piece, because somehow the whole will only be in putting those together into some way. As we look at our history, I'm going to take this is a very brief splash of paint. The way I've looked at history is in terms of ages and transition periods. Transition periods run about 100 years, and then there is a period of time that runs about six centuries. And you can almost see them happening. The first century, the entering into the apostolic age. The fourth century, the birth of the age of Christendom. The 10th, 11th century, the birth of the age of faith, the Middle Ages. And then the age of reason, which is our own modernity. The age of reason. It is this last one that has become the one that's been dominant. Now, if you want to see how did it change from the age of faith to the age of reason, I'll use a little example that's true of history. About Johann Sebastian Bach, as you know, he was a musician. And even in those days, musicians had to do something else to earn a living. And so he went to the church to get a job, and they asked him to teach in the school. So he became a teacher of music. As you might guess, the only thing he could think of doing was taking the biblical stories and put them into music. That's how he taught. Well, when Ernesti, the new principal of the school, got on the market, he didn't think they should do that. He said they ought to sing less and study more. Well, Bach lost, Ernesti won, that's the end of the age of faith and the birth of the age of reason. It was a huge mix or loss of the age in which we emphasize the intuitive way of thinking and knowing. The intuitive way of thinking and knowing, which is given to us primarily by the arts. And the intellectual way of thinking and knowing, primarily the sciences. It's not a question, again, of either or, it's a question of both and. How do we keep those two together? But in the age of reason, we basically denied or rejected the age of in the intuition. Everything began to change. Even how we defined ideas changed. How we defined terms changed. Huge shifts. Now, some people entered the age of reason and rejected it. They were also part of the church. They went in another direction. They went underground, and they began to create anti-intellectual movements. The church became a place where you didn't think, you didn't use reason, because it would only get you into difficulty. And so you had this great movement of saying the intellect, reason, was the answer to everything. But those who wouldn't accept that went underground and became anti-intellectual. They also did something else, though, that worked against them, and that is they became literalistic. They took everything literally. They forgot that the gospel's a story. If you take any story literally, you destroy the story because you're going to miss out on what it's about. What is it to live in this world of bringing the intuition back into our world? It's not going to be easy. As you know, if any of you are in the arts, the first people fired and the last people hired in schools teach art. And so we basically have ruled the art out. The church has done the same thing. Most of what we do that we call art in the church isn't art at all. So we either accept the arts, but we don't really use them, or we misuse them, or we don't. That's been our history. There are other forces going on as well in this transition, because I'm convinced that the key to understanding an age is to understand its transition period. We have been in transition of the age of reason since my enter into the field and my career, 1950. That we're now living in a transition period which is very different than living in a period in which there's some continuity and some patterns that follow. But the reason the transition is so important, by the way, you don't have a choice whether you're going to be born then or sometime else. But if you are born in it, the challenge is to use that chance to use your imagination, use that intuitive way to see what is needed in a new age. Something was lost in the age of reason. Something was gained. Do not judge it negatively. We'd have no modern medicine or anything else if it was not for the age of reason. But there's a limit. There are moral limits to that way of thinking, that way of being present in the world. And so in this transition time, we have to sort things out. How much do we keep? How do we keep it? How do we adapt to it? Some people call what we're in now in the interim period post-modernity, although that word's used in many different ways. So always go look it up for it, see what the author's using it for, because it means different things to different people. But post-modernity, I'm going to suggest, is this period that began in 1950 and will go to probably 2050 of change, a period of rapid change. Then it will level itself out. Then it will change rapidly again. It's done that throughout history, and we'll do that until the end of time. Now, what were some of the products of this modernity? The products of modernity were very simple. One was specialization. Everything became specialized. For example, medicine became increasingly specialized. So you'd have to go to five specialists to get one person to tell you the same thing. But we also did strange things when we trained physicians. By the way, I'm not sure we did any better training clergy. But that was, for the first 2 years, they didn't have any patient, they didn't see a patient, they did basic science, they had cadavers. We sent you out to do field work in the seminary. And for the first 2 years, you never saw a human being, just other clergy, future clergy. Everything was highly specialized. Let's show you how we did it in theology. Now, theology's always been divided into three parts, like all of Gaul. It was foundational theology, or dogmatic theology, which established what was the basic foundation of the Christian life of faith. It was primarily taught by people who taught patristics, that's the early church, who taught the creeds, who taught scripture, who taught that, and that was primarily dogmatic theology. Then there was constructive theology, or systematic theology, which asked the question, how do we make that foundation apply to certain particular people? So we had feminist theology, we had Afro-American theology, we had process theology, we had all kinds of different theologies, all of which took the foundation and tried to speak to a particular group and their ways of dealing with thought and life. The third kind was called practical or applied theology. We're beginning to use that word again, although I can't find anybody who agrees on what it means. But I'll tell you what I think it means, and because it's been my discipline throughout my career. And that practical authority and theology is really six dimensions that are interrelated. They all broke apart and became specialties. So you had a professor of education, had a professor of this, professor of that. Spirituality all dried up. Pastoral care modeled itself after secular psychology and began to worry about therapy and counselors. Catechetics became modeled itself after secular education and psychology. Ecumenics became how religious communities talk to each other and work together. And so all of a sudden you had all of these specialties, all isolated from each other, not interrelating, not seeing how they fit into a common pattern of how we ask the question, how do we as believers in Jesus Christ and members of his body to live our lives in the world? Another part of it was not specialization, but was functionalism. The world seen as objects and the creation of institutions. If you think functionalism is what we do. Being is dependent on what you do. So if somebody asks you, who are you? That's sometimes difficult to answer, so you usually tell them what you do. That's how we've connected it. And when you can't do anything anymore, you wonder if you're of any worth anymore. We're always trying to do something. That's how we mess the world up differently. We're going to build God's reign. I hope not. First of all, God builds it. God has already built it. We're supposed to abide in it. To live as if it's here in its fullness until it can come in its fullness. A very different thing. We're always doing something, though. Our whole language is the language of doing, rather than the language of being. I had a colleague once in one of my parishes who asked every committee that met to, at the end of the meeting, sit down and write down how they thought the time they spent there had contributed to God's reign. And if they couldn't answer it, maybe they didn't need to meet again. It was wonderful, eliminated half the meetings in the church. See, we forget that life is not all doing. It is also being. It's why we got in trouble with children and adults. See, we defined a child as being dependent, being non-rational, intuitive. Children are naturally intuitive until we tell them what a painting looks like. People are naturally creative. It's God-givenness. And that image of God is to create. But we take it away from people and tell them they're not creative. You can't sing, you can't dance, you can't do these things. But at any rate, children are non-productive. They play. Well, how do we define an adult? Somebody who's independent, not dependent, somebody who's rational, not non-rational, somebody who is productive, who doesn't play. And so what we've done is we've already created a split in our lives of how we understand children and adults. The world is objects. Objects, we turn everything into an object so we can investigate it and so we can manipulate it. Psychology, that's what psychology is a social science. It's how do we analyze people so we can control them? How do we understand how everybody learns so we can make it happen? Strange idea of wanting to be in control. To be in control of another life and just know enough about them and we can pull it off. Of course, we never do that. We never can pull that off, fortunately. But there's always an attempt to want to know exactly how it works. Put people in categories and boxes. None of them ever fit. But the mere fact you've been put in a box, you begin to act like that box. We did the same thing with ecology, with the nature, with nature. It's there for our manipulation, for our use. We've done strange things along the way. You realize that we never had a phenomenon called adolescence until 1904? 1904, G. Stanley Hall wrote a book called Adolescence, and ever since we believed it exists. Have you ever pondered the idea that adolescence does not exist? It's a social construction of reality and not a helpful one? That would be better to think of children and adults and that period, which could be fairly short, in which you're journeying into adulthood, is just help you to make the transition. But it's not a way of life that goes on forever and ever. It used to be nobody wanted to be children anymore. Now nobody wants to be an adolescent anymore. They want to be an adolescent forever. Until you can't do that anymore. We've done it also with scripture. We turned the scriptures into a piece of literature for us to analyze, to question. Not a book that questions us, but a book we question. See, we've done that because the world is an object, and we are doers. Now, that's part of modernity. We didn't sit down and say, that's how we're going to understand people, or anything else. That is indeed what happened to us over those 5-6 centuries of the Age of Reason. They were the natural outcomes. The other one that came with it was institutions. The development of institutions. So the word institution is not a helpful word because it's the place where specialization takes place. It's a place that is less than personal. It creates bureaucracies. It is something that is not in and of itself healthy, but that doesn't mean you throw out the baby with the bathwater and therefore you don't want to relate to anything that is institutional. Rather, what you work on is how do you develop communities of faith? Rather than institutions of religion. But you can't have faith and you can't have a spiritual life in relationship with God without a community. We are communal persons by definition. You cannot be human alone. One person is no person. Well, what is a community? We're always talking about building community. That's a functional idea that you can build community. You can't build community. Don't take your time and energy trying to. Community is a gift. But there's certain criteria you can meet so the gift can be given. Communities have a common story. A common story that holds us together as a people. Remember Walker Percy's wonderful essay, The Message in the Bottle. It was about these people who were on an island. They had been shipwrecked. And they got on the island and they knew that wasn't their home, but they didn't know where their home was and they didn't know how to get there. So they'd wander the beach every day looking for things that might give them a clue. And one day they found a bottle. And in the bottle was a message. It was a story. And so they knew who they were. In this case, for the author of that particular Walker Percy, it was the Christian story. There was a story in that bottle. It told them where they had come from, where they were going, what they were about. And all of a sudden, their life took on meaning and purpose because they had a story that they had lost. Common authority. If you you have a common authority, something you point to that's the author for your thinking, for your decision making, for your life. If you have a common authority, you can tolerate huge amounts of difference. But if you don't have the same authority, you will just fight and argue past each other in the night. Because it is that common authority that holds you together. Or common ritual. Common ritual is very much a part of it. Common ritual, liturgy, liturgy means the work of the people. All human life has two modes. One is ritualistic or cultic life, the other is daily life. And they play back and forth. Your daily life ought to influence your worship or prayer influence your daily life. They go back and forth together. And the last is a common life together that's more like a family than is like an institution. That's the key. Now, what's the difference? Well, in families, all of life encompasses a family's life. In institutions, rather, we specialize. In families, it's the total person that's important, but in institutions, you're task-oriented. You're known by what you do and your task. Emotions in the family can be expressed, or at least a healthy family can be expressed. But in the world, you don't bring that emotions to work. You don't sit at your desk for the first 10 minutes and cry if you want to keep your job. Families do things by custom. Institutions do it by laws and regulations. Everybody knows how you're supposed to behave. You may not do it, but you know how you're supposed to. That's custom. If you go then and say, how do you relate to each other? In a family, it's by a covenant, whatever love demands. But in institutions, it's by contract. You do A, I do B. And last, in a family, it's your being that's important. Institutions, it's your performance or your behavior and value to the community.